Okay. Today, I am in the office of David Washa. David, would you like to introduce yourself and what it is that you do for Microsoft?
Sure. My name's Dave Washa, as Rory said, and I work with partners, so both device partners and software partners, ISVs and developers, on developing both compatible and very cool applications and products for Windows Vista.
So when you say that you work on developing like compatible products, what do you mean exactly? Like
Well, anytime we have a new release of an operating system, well, not anytime, but a lot of the time when we have a new release of a new operating system, we make some breaking changes in the operating system. That is, changes that would cause existing applications or devices to not work as expected on the new operating system. We do that for a number of reasons. It could be anything from security to other kind of investments we want to make in innovation. There are a couple of areas where we've done that in Windows Vista. But when we talk about compatibility, it's about educating our partners on what those breaking changes are, and then going out and making sure that they have the tools and the information and the help that they need to both work on their existing products as well as plan for the future.
So how does that work? I mean, do you have like a list that somebody sent you of like what's broken? I mean, how would you even begin to do this? I mean, it's huge, right?
Yeah.
It's got to be like scary.
It is. It's not scary.
I shoot video for a living. To me, it's scary.
The size of I think the scary thing is the size of the ecosystem, right? It's the number of people that we have to communicate with and work with. But actually, our approach to compatibility is pretty cool. We start thinking about compatibility before we ever write a single line of code with the product. And that is, we start to engage with partners. We start to engage with enthusiasts. We start to engage with architects and from around the industry. And we have a discussion with them. Any time that we consider making a breaking change, it's a non-trivial decision. And so we really need to discuss the merits. Is the innovation, is the benefit to the customer, is the benefit to the partner worth making the breaking change?
Well, this is actually really interesting. So, like, what kind of stuff would you look at? I mean, coming here, I didn't know exactly what to expect today. First off, I didn't expect to see a tinfoil ball and a tinfoil hat, and you've got some explaining to do about the wig. But what I didn't expect to realize was just how complex this could be. I mean, talking to partners, it's like Windows is huge, mm-hmm. right? So
yeah.
You go to them and do you ask them like what APIs are really important to them, or does this work?
Well, like I said, it all started 4 or 5 years ago around this discussion around app compat. And then we do what we call SDRs, or strategic design reviews, which is we invite, the SAPs, the Intuits, the Symantecs of the world to come to Redmond or, other places where Microsoft has campuses and talk about what's important, where we see the need for some innovation, and where we're willing to make breaking changes, especially around things, like I said, like security. And then we eventually get to a point where we have a set of recommended breaking changes that we can go out and start to design against, start to develop against. And then we continue to bring those partners back in to campus through labs to make sure that, we're implementing it in a way that's helpful, that's useful, and allowing them to architect their products side by side with us so that when our product is ready to ship, as we did last week, that their products are ready to go as well.
Okay, see, that's honestly amazing to me because, you see a lot of devs and such talking about breaking changes, and I'm talking about for any system, whether we're talking about OS X or Linux or Windows or whatever, people talk about breaking changes, And at Microsoft, we've occasionally taken some flack, which I think is nuts because, I didn't realize the extent to which we went to ensure that, we were going to keep the customers happy when it came to breaking changes. I mean, what level does it happen at? I mean, do you actually, if Symantec, just for example, came along and said, this one particular API is really, really important to us, then we would keep it? Or, how does this work? It just sounds like such a logistical, mm-hmm. Nightmare in a lot of ways,
Well, you said a couple of things. Let me start with the first thing that you said, which is, one of the things that we've made investments in over the last 20 years is around our ecosystem and backwards compatibility.
Yeah.
It's massively valuable to our partners and to our customers, for that matter. I mean, we've got tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of applications if you count kind of all the shareware and freeware that's out there. and tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of devices, some of them, you know, half a decade or more old. And yet people have an expectation that those things are going to work with the version of Windows that they have.
Yeah.
And the result, the reason for that is because we spend so much time on it. We spend so early in the process working with partners, working with the industry to make sure that that happens. So like I said, we have this ongoing dialogue with partners. We have a kind of a service level agreement or a commitment to the industry, you know, particularly around things like public APIs, right, where we don't want to change public APIs, or if we do, then we can deprecate them and we can offer a new solution and we can work with the partners who have used those APIs to start implementing on top of the new APIs. But if a partner comes to us and you know, we've gathered most of that feedback early on in the process, so there aren't too many occasions where it would be late in the game where someone came to us and said, hey, wait a second, you know, you guys forgot this, or, you know, we haven't done this. The other part of the process, or I guess it's a part of a single process, is, you know, once we work very deeply with the kind of a core set of about, you know, I don't know, 500 partners maybe, around the world. But then we also have the most advanced automated testing facility in the world, where we do, you know, about, we test between 800 and 1,200 applications a day on these 355 servers that are over in building 26. You know, you've seen it, the big racks of servers walking down. We've got about a million lines of code that we wrote just to do that automated testing.
How do we do that? I mean, how does it even work? And how do you choose which apps are going to be tested? That's wild.
Yeah, you know? So how do we choose which apps to be tested? That's actually an interesting question. We come at it from a number of different ways. One is we just look at the unit volume, kind of the biggest shipping apps across all different dimensions. So there's the consumer apps and consumer dimensions, and there's lots of things like antivirus and games and things like that on the consumer front. And then there's the enterprise. So what are the apps that have the huge install base inside enterprises? We look at things like the top downloaded apps off of Windows Marketplace or download.com. We also have a technology adoption program. We call it the TAP, which is a program for customers to get involved in deploying, in this case, Windows Vista, early. And one of the things that results from that process is a list of applications that they're all running and any potential problems that they're having running those applications on early versions of Windows Vista. So we come at it from a number of different angles. We try to make sure that the typical kind of setup, whether you're a consumer or a small business owner or you're working in an enterprise, that we've got most, if not everything, covered through our automated testing facilities. And these labs run 7 days a week, 365 days a year. They never stop. They do about 1.5 million tests a year, I think, on each iterative build of the product.
So with these tests and these different applications, is it a different set of applications each day, or is it the same pool of apps each day that are tested against, you know, progressive builds of Windows or whatever?
I think probably 80% stay the same on a given kind of day-to-day basis. A lot of the time, we're testing very old versions of applications, and once we know that, you know, Adobe Acrobat Reader 4.0 or something works, we might not come back to that one for a while.
Wow. So you just pretty much try to get a good cross-section of what's out there, like just a good representative sample, and make sure that these apps work, and you assume then that, you know, most other apps are going to continue working then.
Yeah, there's a couple of different approaches. Number one, I mean, like I said, the ecosystem's so huge, it's not possible to test everything.
Of course, yeah.
So we try to pick apps that are very representative of a category, right?
Okay.
Like a couple of really popular antivirus apps, a couple of really popular DX7 games, right? Things like that. What we do is all of these tests run, then any exceptions that happen or bugs that happen flow out and go through a triage process, a couple of things happen then. A lot of those there's something called the bug investigation team. It's like a SWAT team for bugs around App Compat. And they might fly out to a site to work with a partner on site. They might just work with the partner over the phone. They might bring them onto campus, but the bug investigation team does that. They'll also file bugs against Vista or Windows Client, itself, and those bugs go through the normal bug triage and resolution process as a part of the product. But what results from all that is some core root causes, right? There's a lot. You see a lot of things happening at the breadth of apps we have, but it comes down to a handful, a dozen, you know, maybe early on in the process, it's two dozen root causes. And so early on, it's all about detecting new root causes. It's trying to just get a very diverse set of applications so that you can, there are no unknowns about app compat out there. And then later in the game, it's about taking the more recent and the more widely used applications and just making sure that they work.
So do you find that some companies like do some really, really, really crazy hacks and you know, get into bits of the system that you never expected them to and kind of throw a bit of a wrench into the works, or do you ever see that?
No, oh yeah, of course we see that. I mean, there are, you know, a lot of folks out there who
using like undocumented APIs or
they have a really novel approach to solving a problem that we didn't expect someone to use, and it may result in a new root cause. There might only be a couple of apps, right, that actually do that. So it's a low volume bucket, but it might be a very popular application, in which case we have to go out and work with them anyways.
Well, there was a post, I think Raymond Chen wrote it about maybe 2-3 years ago. I could be totally wrong about that. It could have been 6 months ago, but he wrote it. I'm pretty sure it was him anyway. So, so what we're getting at here is I'm unsure of both the author and the date, but I know there was a post out there, and it was about how it was either DOS or an early version of Windows. You know, there was code in there just like specifically to make certain apps compatible, like down to the level of SimCity was trying to just do some crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. And so there was code that was put into DOS just to make SimCity run, you know?
Yeah, so, we call them shims.
How many of those
today?
Do we have?
Absolutely.
Like,
there are hundreds of those today.
Just for specialized apps?
Yeah,
wow.
For specific. There are shims for categories. So, for example, if an application in its install process checks to make sure that the version of Windows that it's running on is Windows XP, then that installation will fail on Windows Vista.
Yeah, that happened to me yesterday. Yeah.
Now, well, that's a... come back to that in a second, because there's an interesting feature in the product that helps you get through that problem.
Oh, okay.
But if that application lets us know by going up to innovateonwindowsvista.com,
I'll make sure to get that in there. So if we go to HTTP, innovateonwindowsvista.com, and I'll make sure that everybody can see that. Nice. Okay, so let's just break for about 30 seconds, just talk about what that site is, and then we'll come back to the question. Is that okay?
So innovateonwindowsvista.com is our single entry point for ISVs and developers into all the things that they need to be thinking about preparing their applications, whether they're existing legacy apps or they're new apps that they're working on now to get ready for Windows Vista.
Okay.
It's app compat information, like some of the stuff we're talking about. It's information on how to participate in some of our co-marketing programs, like the Certified for Windows Vista logo program. And then just information on, you know, some of the kind of what we call the light up features, or some of the cool new developer features that really exploit the new platform.
And all that info is over there?
All that info is there. And it'll take you off the MSDN and a bunch of different places. But if you go to one place to find out about Windows Vista as a developer or ISV, that's the place you should start.
Cool. Okay, so then back to the shims.
So the shims. So I was using the example of if an install checks for a version, Windows Vista is obviously a new version,
yeah,
the install might fail. If an ISV goes up to innovateonwindowsvista.com and they profile their application, they can say, hey, my app, this app, version, whatever, out in the market, checks, you know, does the install check, and I need the install shim to be registered with my app. And so that we have in box the ability to look at the app and say, yep, well, we're doing this, these guys let us know, and so we will automatically install that shim with that application so that the end user never experiences that problem.
Okay, so we go to some pretty crazy lengths then to ensure that there is app compatibility from version to version.
We do, yeah. I mean, a lot of it, some of it is breaking changes that we do, and a lot of it, frankly, is just poor coding on the part of people. Poor or... you know, I don't know what the word is. We didn't give the right information
that's
at the time.
Okay.
I don't want to insult anybody.
No. You know, I honestly think it's important to sometimes... we're getting to a point now where we just got to be honest with customers.
Because
I was talking to the UAC guys, you know, and and they were talking about how there was all this code that, you know, just kind of, you know, just went wild with, you know, the registry and the file system and just had its way with everything. And that made it really difficult for us to implement a good security model.
UAC is a great example.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we haven't really enforced anything around these poor coding practices in the past. Like, people kind of willy-nilly, you know, trod over the registry, even if it's system registry settings. And they can write to it, you know, sometimes, you know, it's because they don't know any better, and sometimes they're actually trying to be malicious. Either way, we let them do it. And so the industry has kind of gotten used to, some, you know, certain segments of the industry have gotten used to maybe laziness, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But you know, when we look at, you know, Windows Vista, when we do all of our security reviews, we look at the surface area, the attack surface area that the malware people are coming in at, we've tried to identify those key things, and obviously the registry is one of them, and running as an admin when you don't need to be is another thing. And so what you get is, in some applications, the user account control dialog box popping up like every 3 seconds. And so we do have a shim for that. But as a part of that, what's cool is, because we get this question a lot, which is, okay, what's the value of making security innovations if you're going to let people, if you're going to enable people to continue to do the wrong things? Well, in this case, the shim is not just, it doesn't turn off UAC, but what it does is it virtualizes the registry. So it, the application thinks it's writing to the registry, but it's actually writing to a sandboxed, walled-off virtual registry.
That's awesome.
And they can go and do whatever they want with that. It's kind of like being in the Matrix, right? It's its own little matrix. It took the red pill. And so we're fine with that because we know it can't do any harm to the rest of the system, and it thinks that it's going about it the its, you know, business the way that it used to.
I love the idea of duping software.
Well, I think that's going to largely how we're going to do this going forward. Is we will kind of have to mend these poor coding practices because we don't want apps to break either, right?
I mean,
we're not just going to a lot of you know some platform providers. Make the conscious decision to just, when we move forward, everything needs to move forward with us.
Yeah, I am an Apple.
Yeah, so I was at an Apple store the other day, and I saw someone came in, they were super frustrated because they bought a new, it was really actually a nice machine, they bought a new PowerPC. Is that what it was? Smoking big box, like with, you know, dual mon, big huge mon.
Oh, okay.
Anyways, but he didn't realize he's going to have to buy $2,000 worth of software that I get into the RDS. So he was really frustrated. So that's one choice, right? I mean, if you're a platform provider, you have to make a decision. I think there are benefits and merits to each choice.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I kind of consider that the Apple tax, you know? Like in my own life, I've been, you know, hit by that quite a few times because I always update to the latest version of OS X. But, you know, it's like the price you pay sometimes for innovation. And I was going to ask you, and this is sort of a big question. I mean, do you think that, like, some of these poor coding practices and some of the, you know, app compatibility requirements hold us back from being able to innovate? I mean, if it weren't for app compatibility, would we, like, throw everything away and rewrite our APIs from the ground up?
You know, that's a really interesting question. It's something that we struggle with on a daily basis and that we talk about all the time. I mean, we spend... us, for example, not necessarily an app example, but we spend a lot of time and effort making sure that we have updated drivers for all these devices out there, right? Even some devices that, like a $29 scanner that you bought 6 years ago, right?
Yeah.
But it's probably, you know, in a closet or in a dump somewhere. But we spend a lot of time making sure that if someone has that $29 scanner that they bought 6 years ago and they plug it into Windows Vista, that it's going to work.
Yeah.
And that the opportunity cost of that is that you're spending a lot of time making sure old stuff works at the expense of moving the platform forward. And so it's an interesting, you know, philosophical discussion or whatever, you know, around a beer to sit down and say, which would you choose if you could start over again?
Yeah.
I think one of the things that we know people expect and attribute value to with Windows is the breadth of stuff that runs. And the fact that in most cases you can upgrade an operating system without having to upgrade hardware or software. And that's the path that we've been on for the last two decades, and I think we're going to continue to do it. It is sometimes frustrating because we've got a lot of passionate people here who want to go out and innovate and do the new and the coolest things. And in a lot of ways, you might say we're limited by the kind of the least common denominator,
yeah.
right, of the industry. But we do make, you know, like, especially around something like IPv6, right?
Mm-hmm.
We do make a choice. We say, look, we need to innovate here for a number of reasons, for security reasons, for capacity reasons. and so we are going to make a breaking change around the networking stack. And we need to get the industry to go along with us. But this is going to be one of those areas where it might be more painful than it otherwise is because we've decided to do this. But we think, and we've spoken with partners and we've spoken with people in the industry, we think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
We just put a ton of thought before we make those decisions, and a lot of things never see the light of day because the value to the customer or the industry is outweighed by the pain that it might cause to
yeah.
make that breaking change.
This is a story that I think, you know, just doesn't really get enough light, you know, or just doesn't get enough attention, really. In some ways, right, you know, we're sort of held back a little bit because we have to make sure that all these apps are compatible, right? And in other ways, you know, we really want to move forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we've kind of got our hands tied. So you're going to have some customers complaining that maybe, you know, we aren't pushing forward fast enough. You know, and you've got others complaining that, well, you know, VB2 isn't running,
yeah.
you know, on my machine. So that's a tough position to be in.
It really is. But we're, you know, we've got 600 million people around the world that use the product.
Yeah. So rather important that we.
And so, but I think that one of the stories that doesn't get told is how passionate the people here are about trying to have the best experience for end users that
mm-hmm.
they possibly can. I mean, if you go talk to the guys that run the automated testing lab, or you talk to the guys that do the hands-on labs that they bring partners with, they're just, you know, they really, every question starts with, how does this affect the end user? And you pointed it out, we're kind of damned if we do and damned if we don't
yeah.
on all kinds of different fronts. Some people say we don't innovate enough. Some people say that, you know, their six-year-old $29 scanner doesn't work with the product. We're kind of caught in the middle.
Yeah.
But we do the best we can.
Yeah. So what about going forward? I mean, you want to talk about some of the – you were talking about things lighting up on Vista. Did you want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. So just to hit – just kind of close out on the app compat piece. There are – if you go up to innovateonwindowsvista.com, there's all the information you need to make your apps compatible. We want people to go out and let us know about their existing apps and what, you know, what shims they need, but also that information, if they profile their app on that site, will flow into the upgrade advisor. I don't know if folks have probably seen that. If you go up to, what's it called, Get Ready, windowsvista.com/get ready, you can download the upgrade advisor. And it scans your machine and it says, no, this will work, that won't work, we don't know if that's going to work, here are the new updated drivers to make this work. And when you profile your app up on that site, it'll make sure to have that accurate information when, you know, millions, mostly of consumers, download this thing and run it on their PC.
Yeah, that worked really well for me. I mean,
yeah.
I've installed Vista a few times now, and, you know, the RTM.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually, you know, been pretty snazzy the way that it actually goes through and tells me what's going to happen, what isn't going to happen, because I didn't have that luxury with some other
mm-hmm.
systems that I've used, you know?
Yeah.
So it's nice to have that.
I mean, we're really thinking...
Hey, wait, how does it know? How does it know it isn't going to work? I mean, I'm just wondering, this suddenly dawned on me that, I mean, how does it know?
Well, it knows, because we get software vendors to tell us whether or not their apps work. And
huh.
then that's a database. It looks for the signature, it pops up, and it tells us.
So we've got a DB of all these apps, and wow.
And devices, yeah.
Okay.
Millions of devices, tens of thousands of apps, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
And some of them it's I don't know. And if it's I don't know, we really want folks to tell us so we can say yes or no. Sometimes it's yes, and we like that, and sometimes it's no, and I think even if it is no, it's better for end users to know.
Yeah.
So their expectations are set appropriately.
Oh, I totally agree.
Yeah.
I mean, we could just pretend like everything's going to work and just look the other way, you know, but it is nice to have that list.
There was one more I wanted to bring up, because you brought this up earlier, where you tried to install.
Yeah.
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 So we've got this thing called the compatible, what's it called? Now someone's going to be pissed because I can't remember the compatibility assistant, I think.
Okay.
Anyways, and it will, it looks, it kind of keeps track when you're installing things. And if the install fails, it looks at it and it looks reasons why it may have failed. And so in your case, you may have had the experience where it popped up afterwards and said, hey, I noticed you're trying to install this thing. We have a pretty good idea of why it didn't install. You want us to give another shot at doing it. And if it is something as simple as a version check or something like that, it will automatically, even if we didn't hear from the vendor beforehand or it wasn't in our database, we'll automatically slide the appropriate shim in there so that the app works. So it's like the last, you know, the last
just giving it a shot, yeah.
Yeah, against compat. So 4 years ago, from design to millions of tests to hundreds of thousands of visits with partners, you know, if something made it through all of those things, the last line of defense is this compatibility assistant built in.
Okay, yeah, this is a driver install, and it just said, you're not running Windows XP later. And yeah, so I'm going to try that again and see if I can get that shim thing to kick in. And
it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think the key quickly around the areas of app compat, user account control is a big one. We have a shim that can fix that. OS version checking, again, same thing. Simple fix, easy to do. 64-bit. We want to see people having a lot more 64-bit support for things like that, but all 64-bit drivers need to be signed now if you're running 64-bit.
Okay.
Which is, again, it's one of those, we've made a decision that the value of the security implications of making sure that any driver is signed on 64-bit outweighs the pain that it may cause people in the short term. Networking, like I said, we made some great strides forward in IPv6. But it's a new networking stack, and so people should familiarize themselves with that. But it all starts at innovateonwindows.vista.com. Yes. Sorry if you can't read my writing.
No, it's
sorry,
totally
it's
legible.
A long URL.
Here, I'll just make sure that everybody gets a chance to see it here. There we go.
All right, great. So, cool new stuff. There's a lot of stuff. I mean, there's so much new stuff, both between the new .NET Framework 3.0 and the things built into Windows Vista, that you really only can do kind of a cursory view of what's new. But I'll talk about a couple things.
Is this stuff at the site?
Yes, it is.
Okay,
yeah,
cool.
So it'll take you off to, in this case, probably MSDN to talk about some of the cool new areas. But the age-old mantra that we always talk about when we talk about platforms is we talk about presentation, we talk about communication, we talk about data. And that mantra pretty much stays the same. The features and platform APIs that we build change over time. So I'll use that kind of age-old mantra to talk about it. The first is presentation. There's a very cool site called cwindowsvista.com, which I didn't write down, which shows you 10 or so demos of some real ISVs doing cool new things with the user interface. So the Windows Presentation Foundation.
What kind of stuff?
So it's everything from cool, like smash-up consumer-y kind of weaving together photos and 3D animations and video.
For the people who don't know, what's a smash-up? Because that's a term that's getting used a lot nowadays.
Smash-up is pulling, you know, services from a ton of different places. So you can pull a service from MSN, you can pull a service from Google, you can pull a service from any number of places, a web service, and pull them together into an application.
So you mix all these services just to create your own.
You smash them up.
Yeah.
Yep, you take these little cool little bits of value around, and you put them together in a package that makes sense for whomever you're building the app for.
When I was a kid, and I'd get a fountain drink at a fast food restaurant, I'd put every single kind of soda in the same cup, so it's kind of like that.
Let's hope it tastes a little bit better than that.
No, I liked it. It's really sweet. But yeah. Okay, so we've got that then. Okay.
So the Windows Presentation Foundation, what we called Avalon, which is a much cooler name than Windows Presentation Foundation.
Yes, really is.
But it's an entirely new graphic subsystem written from the ground up. It's vector-based. It's great support for 3D. Go up to that site, cwindowsvista.com. Tom Skerritt, like the old guy from Top Gun, you know, the
yeah,
guy.
Yeah.
He's like the host
cougar.
Of it. Yeah, no.
He wasn't
was
Cougar, he was Viper. No, not Viper.
Oh,
I
he did have
name.
A call sign.
Yeah, he did, but I know who you're talking about.
Anyways,
yeah.
he kind of is up there. He's the MC for this little demo show that you can go. So you can go and see some of the cool new things that people are doing. On the category of presentation, so you've got Avalon, you've got all the cool new vector-based graphics facilities. If you're a gaming company, we've got DX10. We're going to have some really cool DX10 games coming out, like CES kind of time frame, that take full advantage of DX10 and the new DX10 hardware. One thing that we made a big deal about, then we made less of a deal about, and now we're going to make a big deal about again, is gadgets on the sidebar.
Yeah.
I think when we started to develop Vista, everyone kind of thought gadgets, oh, kind of this novel little thing, you know, I can get my little calendar and a little clock up there. But what we're seeing is the technology matured and people started to adopt it, is people are taking it very seriously. Even large enterprise applications are starting to see it, because you can get a little piece of real estate that can do real-time communication with the end user about just about anything. So that if you have invoices coming in, if you've got, on the enterprise side, obviously there are a lot of obvious consumer applications reading RSS feeds. You can have voicemails coming through overdue bills. Like there's a ton of different scenarios where having a little presence. I mean, and ISVs like that, right? Because they're always kind of adding a little bit of value on the real estate on the screen for end users. And so that's really starting to pick up.
Yeah, I love this sidebar. I think it's fantastic. So.
And I want more people to build stuff for it. We've got a couple hundred, I think, out on the web. Some of them are kooky. I use the traffic one all the time. It's a little traffic thing that sits on and just shows red, green, yellow about my route home, my commute home. So it can tell me it's going to take me an hour to get home.
Nice.
Or 20 minutes. But that's the kind of thing, just little bits of data visualization on the screen that don't need a lot of real estate, but, and using the Windows Communication Foundation, used to be called Indigo, we like that name better, to go out and grab traffic information or invoice information, PayPal information.
We can use, because I remember when Vista first, I was building on a Longhorn build from PDC 2003, and I was making I was making sidebar gadgets, and it was 100% managed code, you know, and you'd take your DLL and then you'd register with the sidebar and it'd go into that nice little secret hiding spot, you know. Now, are we still able to use our managed DLLs and host them out there? Because when I looked, it seemed like it was a lot of JScript stuff.
Well, it's. You can use managed stuff, or you can use DHTML or script or anything you want. I think that's one of the cool things about it is the object model is consistent across, is really independent of the how you implement it.
Okay.
So if you want to do managed code, if you want to do like an unmanaged binary XE, if you want to use JScript or any kind of the DHTML DOM, you can use all of those things.
Okay.
On the gadget.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So it's very cool. So I think that's something that's really going to start to catch on. It's probably, you know, one of the unsung heroes, I think.
Yeah.
It's also one of those things where, you know, chicken and the egg. Like, you need a lot of them that are cool in order for people to start to see the value of it.
Yeah.
So in presentation, if you're a gaming company, look at DX10. Everyone should be looking at the Windows Presentation Foundation. I think up on cwindowsvista.com there's a company called Acroint, which does really cool things with visualizing data for the retail industry.
Mm-hmm.
People often kind of dismiss UI stuff as only for kind of candy for consumers. But
yeah.
What we're seeing is that if you have higher DPI monitors, if you've got more monitors, bigger monitors, that you can really do some fascinating things with data visualization that helps people make decisions in enterprise settings or in business settings. And those are probably going to be one of the next wave of cool applications is companies that are really good at helping either build frameworks for or actually building apps for visualizing data as a part of a decision-making process.
Yeah, I thought, I kind of had the same feeling, you know, that people just sort of, the whole, like, eye candy argument, I don't need WPF, blah, 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 what's, you know, Microsoft is wasting my time, you know, mm-hmm. with all this, you know, with all these hardware requirements, and,
yeah.
you know, I've seen a lot of complaining, but they don't consider just what you can do now in terms of, you know, like you were saying, you know, data representation and everything. Even the calendar gadget, I think, is really cool,
yeah.
just when it comes to data representation.
Yeah.
The way you click on it, it'll switch from, you know, view to view to view to view, and it drills down. I mean, it's actually a really novel way of presenting
that's
a calendar.
That's one that I use, I mean,
yeah.
on a daily basis.
It's I love that thing.
It's on my sidebar. Yeah. I guess that's a new question. What's on your sidebar?
What is on your sidebar, actually? Can we see? Can we look? Is that allowed?
I just reloaded.
Or do you have
so
secret
I don't know.
Stuff?
No. I just reloaded the Vista, so I'm not sure if I have all of the ones that I normally use up there. I also can't find the latest version of the traffic one.
Oh, did you go from, like, a release candidate to...
Yeah.
Okay.
So fairly... Okay. Fairly innocuous right now. Take some of my...
It's okay, I'll film the wig for a minute. And just let people wonder about that. The wig and all the tinfoil. All
right, so here's my sidebar. I haven't actually put my pictures on here yet, so it's just showing the example pictures. I've got the CPU.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, because that one's cool.
Yeah.
Clock, which I'll probably get rid of. And then a new one that I found, my dictionary, which takes you, if you type it in, I don't know, what's something we want to look up? Potato. it takes you straight to dictionary.com and the definition of potato. So,
okay.
you know, it's pretty cool. And I find myself doing that anyways, and so I thought that was a handy one.
That's nice.
Yeah. So, gadgets, data visualization, a lot of time the pushback from enterprise customers is, you know, we don't need any of that fancy UI stuff. What we really want is security and reliability and help us manage and deploy it. But I think as a couple of these, you know, Accruent-like applications pop up, people will really start to see that, yes, we can actually do this Star Trek-like stuff. We
yeah.
can actually do it now.
So you'd suggest that people go to innovatewindowsvista.com to check out the Accruent apps to see what can be done? Or?
You can go there and it'll take you off, or the direct URL is just cwindowsvista, S-E-E, windowsvista.com.
Oh, okay. So cwindowsvista, and that'll show the
take
Accruent.
Take you right to the apps.
If people need ideas on how to do some data visualization.
Yeah.
Hint.
Yeah. So it's very, very cool.
Yeah.
And the CEO from Accruent, it was interviewed, and he said, look, like... sexiness and coolness and, you know, good, valuable use of data is something worth investing in. And it's something that we're banking on as a strategic direction for our company. And
yeah.
we think that it's going to put us in the lead in our industry. I mean, they're banking on investing in making data visualization real.
I can industry. Totally see that, yeah, because
yeah.
I went and talked to a lot of the, you know, I talked to the Expression team, and I've talked to some people about WPF, WPFE, and all that, and getting to actually see, you know, what's possible. I mean, in the old days, to like this is the example that I always think about is, you know, what did it used to take to draw a button the way you wanted to draw a button, you
yeah.
know? Like, quite a bit of
yeah.
work that nobody wanted to do. And now you can actually just draw the thing, you know?
And you can have video,
so, yeah.
live video looping in the background
right.
behind the button if you want.
Yeah.
We'll have, I mean, I don't know what the new, you know, the new blinking text or the new marching
right.
ants,
the marquee tag,
of WPF will be, but I'm sure that people will find
they'll abuse it like crazy
ways of using it. Yes.
Yeah.
So presentation, tons of stuff there around communication. Again, there's Indigo, and there's we make it vastly easier for people to do mashup style stuff. But enrich clients, right? We can go out and pull information from all of these different services around the web and bring that information into an application that's in a gadget or in an application. But the foundation for that is Windows Communication Foundation or Indigo. And we've got a whole new set of APIs for enabling RSS, so really simple syndication, information coming into... Windows Vista, so you've got RSS feeds built into Outlook 2007. There's an RSS gadget for reading feeds on the sidebar.
So we've got RSS APIs just built into Vista now?
We do.
Okay.
Yeah. So using that as a way of pulling information from sources and sort of bringing it into applications is something that we believe people, I mean, they already are. I mean, we want to make it vastly easier than it is today to do that. And all kinds of applications, not just using it for content, like simple, like, you know, reading a blog. But, I mean, we think there's, you know, people are going to really start to use it for a ton of other stuff.
Notifications and, there's there are
I mean,
a lot of uses.
Podcasting is another example, but...
Do we have managed APIs to get to the RSS?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You wouldn't happen to know the namespace off the top of your head, would you?
Now you've got me.
Sorry.
but I will. We'll find out. We can let everyone know.
Someone might even know, and they'll just leave a comment.
I'm sure.
There's a lot of miners who just like research this stuff inside out, like mad.
Or they'll prove me wrong because it got cut and I didn't read that.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's there.
Yeah. So there's that. One of the things that we haven't made a very big deal about, again, is our peer-to-peer technologies built into Windows Vista. So we call it People Near Me.
I've seen that. What is that? Yeah.
So we built our own app on top of an Vista called Meeting Space, and it allows you to create ad hoc wireless networks to do live meeting kinds of things, like sharing a presentation. Transferring documents, doing instant messaging. And so when we have meetings, like our team meeting, we'll sit around and we'll start a meeting space session.
Hmm.
Everyone will log in. It's not through the corporate wireless network. It's literally ad hoc wireless network.
So you get taken off, though, if you were on the corporate network wirelessly before, it'll take you off that wireless network and make you a part of this network?
It won't take you off it. This will be an additional network that you're on. Yeah.
Cool.
It's very cool. I mean, so you can sit next to someone on a bus and do a session with them.
If you trust the person, of course.
Well, yeah. but, you know, anyways, very cool. Meeting Space is our app. It's built into Windows Vista, and that's built on this People Near Me technology. Hmm. And there's the peer name resolution protocol is, I think, the underlying set of APIs. But anyways, it's all the infrastructure that allows you to ride on, take advantage of these ad hoc peer-to-peer networks. And I think that you'll start to, that's another area, I mean, who knows, with the kind of the advent of ultra-wideband, all those kinds of things, you'll start to see that take off as well. Kind of peer-to-peer mesh networking kinds of applications where you don't want to have to rely on everyone being on the same networking infrastructure or the same provider, et cetera. Or if you're at a place where you don't have wireless, which is becoming increasingly rare. so that's another, you know, that's another example. You've got RSS, you've got the Windows Communication Foundation, you've got the peer networking. Another example of some of the investments that we're making around communications. Then there's data, right? And there's, I think, the most obvious change, one of the most obvious changes in Windows Vista is the search and organize functionality. So everywhere you go, from the start menu to IE to individual applications to Outlook, you've got one consistent indexed universe and with a very snappy response when you're doing searches. And that is a result of, obviously, a ton of investment in Indexer. There's a set of APIs on it. If people want their applications or their documents to be indexable, they can go out, and again, you're going to ask me for the namespace. they can go out and expose, if it's a document, they can put their document in a specific format and register it with iDocument, I think is the, is it? or they can open up their data source and have it be indexed by the core indexer as well.
Cool.
So that their stuff pops up. It's one of the, you know, I think it's obviously one of the more obvious ones, but it's one of the more dramatic changes. I have a XP machine that I'm still have this kind of a doorstop at home right now, and every time I try to use it, I go to the start button and try to search on something. And
yeah,
it there. So
I can't go back either now. Yeah. It's starting to start. I've hit the it bugs me stage.
Yeah.
That is cool. So we can write our own filters for searching that include, like, specifications for metadata that we can provide ourselves. And
you can provide metadata. This shows up in a couple places. It shows up in search. It also shows up in the document viewer, right? And so if you want your, you know, people to be able to sort or stack or view by your document type or your metadata on your document, or if you want them to be able to view thumbnails, of the document. So if you natively, if you go up and you look at in one of the views in the document viewer, you see actual thumbnails of the first page of the first slide, so that you don't need to double click and drill in and see if that's the right document. And you, anyone can expose their files that way, as long as they provide the ability to do that translation to provide a thumbnail to the document viewer.
Cool.
So it's very cool. So I think, you know, around data, you know, obviously everything's XML, everything's indexed. people should, you know, go through iDocument and iFilter to let their documents be indexed, to be able to expose their metadata to the core system. And then we have a new document format called XPS, or the XML Paper Specification, which is essentially an entirely XML-based product/platform-neutral document spec for moving data around between applications, between platforms, etc. And it enables some really cool things. I don't know if you've played around with Outlook, Office 2007, but the lines between an Excel spreadsheet and a Word doc and a PowerPoint really start to get blurred. And the reason for that is because they're, you know, with XPS, they're able to, all those different applications are able to pick and choose the pieces that are relevant to them, independent of the application, et cetera.
Okay, I get it. So they just ignore whatever data doesn't matter to them.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah. All right. It's that's one of the enabling technologies behind it. And it also allows you to lock down documents. You can put any kind of rights and security on them if you have the right viewers, et cetera, and move them around, and you'll start to see printers that pop up that natively support it, which gives you a great level of fidelity between what you see on the screen and what you actually get when you print out, as opposed to in past versions of PowerPoint, you might have a beautiful slide on your screen, you print it out, looks absolutely nothing like it,
right.
Everything's jumbled around. But we're really trying to have a high level of fidelity between all of the different ways of viewing and producing the content. And one of the underlying technologies that enables that is XPS.
Cool. I did not know that.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, in a nutshell, I mean, that's kind of a lot of the cool new stuff that's going on with Windows Vista for developers. I mean, there's so much more, you know, we could spend many more of these sessions. You should spend many more of these sessions with many people smarter than I am on the topics to drill into it, and you'll start to see more of these pop up. We've got about 1,000 different ISVs globally that we're working with that are all going to be shipping their Windows Vista versions of their applications between now and April. And so you will start to see lots of applications that are taking advantage of the communication technology, of the peer-to-peer networking technology, of the presentation stuff.
We haven't really seen anything that takes advantage of Vista yet, like really.
Right, because you can't really, as an end user, you can't get it yet, right?
Yeah.
You'll be able to get it until the end of January. Businesses can get it now. We did our launch for business customers last week.
But we have yet to really see the Star Trek-y apps in the...
Right. And that'll start happening, you know, as soon as we launch. You know, you'll see a lot of apps that are shipped on the day that we launch, but then starting to be rolled out
in
the next couple of months as well.
So that's all good information and everything. There's one thing, though, that you can tell me that nobody else on this campus can probably tell me.
What's that?
What's with the wig?
So the wig was, I made a bet with my team. We were trying to...
You lost this bet, I assume.
I did lose the bet. In fact, there's a picture on the door. I'll show you in a second. I lost the bet, and the result was the winner of the bet got to choose both the wig and the day that I needed to wear it. And I needed to wear it the entire day. So they picked the day when I had lots of meetings with customers and partners.
Oh, man.
And a presentation with our vice president. And I had to wear the wig for that entire day.
David, would you demo the wig?
I will demo the wig, but you can also see the picture on the door here.
That's... Oh, my.
This, yeah, that one, too.
Oh, wow, what a sweet little princess.
Wow, that is really a horrendous wig.
You want the real deal?
Let's get a demo, just before I take off. See what it looks like when you lose a bet on the Microsoft campus.
This is what happens
it's kind of actual, like,
when
ahead.
You get outsmarted by your team at Microsoft.
So you had to wear that in front of customers and
customers, partners, RVP.
Yeah. Yep. How did you explain that?
I told them, well, they knew. They're like, what, you lose it, not like it. That's exactly what
That is awesome. Your team is mean.
They put my car for sale in the Seattle PI, too. Yeah.
They tried to sell your car.
They did. They put it, said something like, leaving the country, need to sell fast. They put it about half the Blue Book value. So I got about 200 phone calls that week for the car.
That is cool. Yeah. All right, man.
Yeah.
What kind of car?
Subaru Outback.
Yeah. At half the cost. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Wig, car. Crazy. Mm-hmm. All right, man. Well, thank you very much, David.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, cool. Well, and I guess everybody just make sure you go to innovateonwindows.com. And what is it?
See Windows Vista. SeeWindowsVista.com.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks for the interview. And okay, bye.
Bye.
Wig man.